Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, currently writer and producer of Criminal Minds on CBS. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard and director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And Lisa Zambetti, casting director for Criminal Minds and Beyond Borders.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are very happy to be back with Bill Thomas in our studio, and we're going to be talking about our next installment of the Colonial Parkway murders. Bill, welcome back. We understand you've had a really interesting week.
Thank you. I decided to go to Williamsburg in the absolute hottest week of the year. 101 degrees and 80% humidity. It was great fun.
Well, I hope it was at least productive. Can you tell us what you were doing there for a week?
Yeah, I had a week in my schedule that opened up, and I decided to try to get back to Williamsburg to do a bunch of media interviews. And all of this is in anticipation of the 30th anniversary of the Colonial Parkway murders.
And how did that feel?
It was a little hard at first. My first thought in thinking about the case was there is no way a murder took place here. You're 35 feet from the road at maximum. So sitting there, I thought, if you killed someone, you're basically killing someone right next to the road.
Right. And since you drove the whole 23 miles,
right,
is there any place along that road that you did see that there's a much higher level of privacy?
Yes. While I was there, one of the people that was interviewing me when we were done, he said, I want to show you something. And I said, sure. He knows the area. And so we hopped in my little rental car, drove about a half a mile over. We passed one of these pullouts, crossed a creek, and he said, pull over here. And there was a closed gate. And he said, there's a picnic area back here that I want to show you. And we walked back. And way, way back from the road was an absolutely beautiful, secluded picnic grove that's been closed for years. It was open back then. It has been closed for years because they had problems with its seclusion. Gay cruising, people being propositioned back there. It's really beautiful, but it's very isolated from the parkway.
So one of the things Jim and I would do if, you know, we haven't been to this crime scene, but of course we're using your eyes and your ears, but we would go out at that time that this happened because, you know, every place changes. And, you know, what's going on at that time, even though it may be eerie and spooky, et cetera, but you want to be in that location, you want to see what's happening, who's doing what, who's coming and going. And it gives you a real sense of that context. And that's what we hang everything around behavior, decision making.
Is the place where your sister's car ended up, with respect to the proximity of this other very private place, is it the first access to the river? In other words, is this the first pull off where you could actually
push a car
over the edge and get it down to the river?
There's one pull-off that's closer. It's very flat, and there's no drop-off to the water. It's almost like, you know, almost level with the water. It's down right next to this creek. And
so gravity wouldn't help you?
No, not at all. The next pull-off, which is the one where Kathy's Honda was found, that's the first one where there's 15... or so foot, maybe a bit more, drop off where gravity would help you push the car over the edge.
Let's say if you parked your car at the picnic grove and then drove another car to the dump location, you could easily walk back.
Right. By the way, I should probably add, if Kathy and Rebecca went to a place to be romantic, the place where the car was found is just way too exposed for you to be romantic. The picnic grove, or a place like it, and there are others, is a place where if you wanted real privacy, that's where you would go.
Got it. All right, well, that's important.
Wow.
Thank you.
Okay, so yes, there was one other case that we did mention at the start when we were doing the podcast, which was a case that happened 10 years later, which I know you're familiar with, Bill, but just to remind our listeners, it was Lolly or Laura Winans and Julianne Williams. 10 years later, they went for a hike on the Appalachian Trail in Virginia, And they were actually in a relationship, but they kept that quiet. So it wasn't something that they made public knowledge. They weren't open about it. Again, in terms of what was found, their bodies were found and their hands were bound, their mouths had been gagged and their throats were slit, which again, you know, throats being cut, it's actually quite rare. Some of the other things that I noticed in terms of similarities and salient features with Kathy and Becky was that there were no signs of a sexual assault with either of these women, mm-hmm. and no sign of robbery either. So the sexual motivation appears to be absent.
But what we do in behavioral analysis, criminal behavioral analysis, is we use behavior to link crimes that are geographically separate or separated by time. And so those two features, the geographic separation and the time separation, are not as significant if the behavior is spot on.
You know, with cases, as a criminal behavioral analyst, I always look at the what, the where, the when, the how. You don't always have the how. You want to understand the why as well. The why, you know, those things will take you to the who. The who is the person or persons that you're looking for, and that's why the motivation is such a critical part. Because it really does, the victimology, the crime scene and the victim themselves, their body, how they're found, holds a mirror up to the type of person or persons that you're looking for. One of the biggest problems around linking crimes, if there aren't forensics, is actually a lot of times law enforcement have linkage blindness. So they don't actually want to link things until you get forensics that say scientifically it's proven. But with this, what seems to have happened is that a number of double homicides, because of the virtue of the fact that double homicides have been linked, we're trying to, it's like peeling an onion, work out what is fact versus what are things, if you call them urban myths, you know, the fictional things that over time become fact, and you have to strip all of that away. I did the same when I was looking at the Jack the Ripper case, actually, in London, because so much has been written about that case, and actually so much has been written about your sister's murder in terms of what's in the media. And over time, those things just get perpetuated. And it's very difficult for Jim and I to sit here, not have access to all of the investigative reports, to know absolutely this is fact.
Right.
It's not speculation, this is fact.
And Bill, before Laura and Jim get more deeply into their profile, I just had a question, one more question about the crime scene for Kathy. And I hate to ask a question like this, but was her actual death caused by strangulation or having her throat slit?
Having her throat cut. They were still alive. In other words, their hearts were still beating. They might have been unconscious, but their hearts were still beating when their throats were cut. So I think the cause of death is, I don't know the technical term, but...
exsanguination.
Right.
Before the term serial killer was coined, we used to call those crimes murder without motive. And it's because there are so many cases in which there was no discernible motive. There didn't seem to be some obvious reason for the person to have committed these crimes or series of crimes. However, there are some things that I see that are consistent over these cases. And one of the things is that in every case, there's an older person, be it male or female, and a younger female. And it could be that that's significant. It might not be significant, but it is something that kind of stands out to me. And in some of these cases, the significance of that age difference actually makes any sexual activity illegal. Just an anomaly that sticks out in my mind.
Right. I mean, in terms of age, and it can be a difficult thing to say, you know, particularly in terms of girls and women, of, you know, if you don't know much about the victim, just looks-wise, they can look older than what they are. So,
or younger.
Or younger. And you mentioned, you know, Kathy was sort of the older, you know, she wasn't sort of college age. And
right.
I mean,
right.
She was in very good condition, fitness-wise, et cetera.
Yeah, and she was very attractive, and Jim said she looked young.
Yeah, she had a baby younger. Face still, I think, pictures I've seen of her.
So ages can be a little bit deceptive, mm-hmm. I think, when we think about victimology. But I think, to state the obvious, I mean, these are double homicides, which are quite rare, aren't mm-hmm. they, Jim?
Yes, they
Two
are.
Two people at one time to control them and actually carry out an offence tells you that somebody, this person or persons, are more criminally sophisticated, And of course, it depends whether we believe they're linked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and breaking down each offence, as we have done, without actually having the crime scene photos, without having the investigation, the investigative sort of notes, without hearing from the officers who are in the detail of it all, it is quite difficult to say concretely about which cases are linked. But certainly on the basis that you could look at these cases. When I first looked at them, I felt that there was some form of kind of mission kill. They are all doing something in the offender's eyes that is perceived to be a wrongdoing, and that this is more of, for me, looking at the motivation, about some form of revenge and payback related grudge behaviour that probably would involve some kind of preparatory stalking. And when we talk about stalking, you know, we're not necessarily saying, I'm certainly not saying that there's weeks and months of research going into all of these individuals. But I would certainly say, if we take Kathy's case, for example, there is something that feels, when you look at the crime scene analysis and you understand what was done to her, the almost being decapitated, it feels much more sort of personal, and that she was sort of the primary target, with the caveat, of course, that she could well have fought back. Mm-hmm. And she has hair in her hand. But that almost being decapitated, you know, to me feels very much like when we talked about Nicole Simpson. It's very rare to see that in this type of crime.
Right.
And it's not an efficient way in terms of what this offender has done in the first case. It's not a particularly efficient way to kill. But maybe that's a learning point. As we know, offenders will think about things in their head, and there will be a fantasy. And the fantasy and reality never match
together. Right. The reality never lives up to the fantasy. They don't think about everything the first time. And I think that's why, for example, in the first double murder of your sister and her girlfriend, the car was found, you know, hung up on the embankment. And then in the third one, which is only a couple miles away from that location, that the bodies are never found. I think that you talked about control a little bit there, Laura, and I think control is necessary when you have two victims. There's an indicator that there's a control weapon used, and I think that weapon was a gun. I think in the only case in which the gun was actually used was in the Nobling and Edwards murders, and I think that was used as a last resort. I think the offender lost control in the midst of that, committing that crime, and or never actually gained control and resorted to shooting. And that probably really pissed them off, because they weren't able to do what they had intended to do in the first place.
When we look at the facts and the evidence, it looks much more to be targeted, a targeted attack. Certainly when we take Kathy and Rebecca, as opposed to something that, you know, if they're waiting for two women to be in a vehicle as a sense of mission kill, a hate crime that's just purely a hate crime with no personal understanding or knowledge, or, you know, intimacy is too strong a word, I'm just talking about connection, then it would be a very long wait in this kind of isolated area, and to leave things to chance, that doesn't sound like this individual.
Right. Well, I think I agree. I think in the first instance that it could very well have been much more targeted, but I think it can change over time. I think that after that, it could have become a sort of location-based predatory behavior or stalking behavior. In other words, it could be that the first case is what brought the offender to that area, and that afterwards, all they were doing was looking for other ways to relive that same kill.
I think this offender knows this area. You know, the local knowledge element, and just hearing Bill describe it. I mean, we haven't been there ourselves.
When I said the area, I don't mean the overall area. Yes, I believe this offender knows this area well. But those particular sites at the area may be something that he or she was drawn to because of the first kill, and then went back to the same area, not wanting to go to exactly the same place because that was probably lit up. People who were using those areas as lovers' lanes probably stayed away from the area where your sister was killed and moved to other areas, and that may have caused the offender to move along with them.
And my understanding is that did happen. In other words, people were pretty scared.
So you start to narrow it down when you think about over these years, you know, what is the chance, the probability of having two killers targeting two people at any one time in these locations?
Not robbing and not sexually assaulting.
Not sexually assaulting. It feels very targeted. And those two cases in particular at either end feel very salient together. I mean, these are physically fit women. These are women who are used to hiking. They're in their prime. Kathy can certainly take care of herself. You know, these are not people who are going to be sort of naive and green to being out hiking, camping and, you know, and the like. And, you know, these are risky locations too. So you start to layer it and actually it starts to stack up in terms of the behaviorally nuanced aspects.
When you say risky, do you mean risky for the victims or risky for the killer or killers?
For the killer. I mean, in terms of the targeted area with Kathy's case, you know, having one exit point, the time that they spend with the victims too, this takes time. You know, to strangle someone, that doesn't work, and then to decapitate them, to bind them, to do all the things that were done, try and push the car over. This is all taking time, which increases the risk of the offender, somebody coming upon the scene and then being caught in a situation where they cannot escape easily.
It's funny. I have the exact same thought in these examples. You know, unless you've got a boat, and I really, you know, I'm not saying that's out of the question, but there, you know, in the Colonial Parkway setting, there's only two ways out. In other words, you have to drive in either direction of the Colonial Parkway. That's it.
But I feel very confident based on your descriptions that these were disposal sites and much less likely kill sites.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense, the amount of time that had to be spent, that it would have to have been a place that's a little more
secluded, not quite as exposed. And make no mistake, I mean, particular victims chosen at a particular time in a particular place for a particular reason in a particular manner. I mean, this case really illustrates
that.
Kathy and Rebecca.
Well, I went up 2 miles up the road on my little tour and went to the spot where Keith and Cassandra's car was found. It would have been Keith called Celica.
Can we just remind us, our listeners, who they are, just real quick?
Yeah, they're the third couple. They went missing in 1988. Technically, it's a missing persons case because the bodies were never found. Now, they've been gone since 88, so I think they're gone. But Keith's car was found about 2 miles up the road along the same stretch of Colonial Parkway that parallels the York River. And so his is the other example where a car was found on the Colonial Parkway. Now, there are other closed off areas that were open back then that have been closed since because they had problems. And there may be something closer to Keith's site. But first takeaway regarding Keith's site where the car was found, it's even smaller and closer to the road. The car would have been glaringly obvious. And of course, Keith's car, there was no attempt to hide it. It was sitting right there in the open.
And let me ask you this. Was the driver's side door open?
I don't think so, Laura, from the photographs I've seen.
Because obviously, if the door was open, then it would arouse more suspicion. I mean, a vehicle parked up in sort of a beauty spot, but with no one present and a door open and it being left there, abandoned.
The Rangers had driven past the car several times. The car was, I think the original report was that it was abandoned.
There was a report that there was clothing found on the back seat and a wallet that was, you know, you could see that outside of the
I think by looking through the window.
This was a couple that was on a first date, wasn't it?
That's correct. Keith had just broken up with his longtime girlfriend. He was out on a first date with Cassandra Haley, who was very pretty, a young woman. They both went to Christopher Newport University. They were at a party together, and he was supposed to have her back by 2 o'clock. I sort of smile because I think about me as a...
Back in the day.
Yeah, younger man saying, I'll have her back by 2 a.m., which seems sort of crazy.
So up next, we're going to talk to Bill more about his trip to the Colonial Parkway and talk about the other victims. And we're back with Bill Thomas.
So, Bill, tell us what else you learned when you were driving the Colonial Parkway and checking out these different disappearance or murder sites.
Well, while I was there, I took the opportunity to go to the Ragged Island Wildlife Refuge, which is right next to a very long bridge. And I went to the site where David Nobling and Robin Edwards were found. I went to the site, and you start at a parking lot that's right next to the approach to the bridge. So you kind of feel like this is a very busy spot. And then there's a parallel access road that runs kind of directly alongside the bridge that leads down to the water. And at first I thought, this is so strangely busy. But then when you get close to the edge of the water, what happens is that the actual structure of the bridge obscures everything. So it's a peculiar feeling. You're in the open, but it's private. And I thought, this is a very strange place for something like this to have happened. But when you get down to the water, the bridge structure blocks everyone's view so that no one can actually see you down there. They think what happened is that David and Robin, who had met that day.
So they had met at the arcade, hadn't they?
Right.
And they'd driven around for the day. He had dropped her home, and then they both sneak out later on.
Right, and she's quite young. She's only 14
she's
years
14,
old.
She's 14, and this is late on a Saturday night. And
right.
He's 20, she's 14. So
right.
she's a child.
She's a minor.
Yeah.
She is, and he, you know, for what it's worth, has another girlfriend, and, you know.
Well, no, it's a crime.
It's
disturbing. If he was actually having sex with her, then that's a crime. I mean, that's child molestation, and we're not going to, you know, dance around that.
It's a
serious crime.
We have to address
now,
that. And
we don't know for sure that they were having sex, but if they were, and it seems like they wouldn't be out here at night in this kind of situation unless, you know, that was something like that was going on. But it's a serious crime.
And it could also tell us something about motivation too. So,
yes.
You know, it's not about making a judgment in inverted commas. This is about just calling it how it is, because this is a crime. She is a child. This could tell us about motivation too.
In this example, both victims are shot and their bodies end up in the water and they float towards the Atlantic Ocean, which is still some distance away. But they're found 3 days later along the shore. Both victims have been shot. It appears that David may have made a run for it. He's shot in the shoulder and then given a kill shot to the head. And Robin's killed in a similar fashion with a kill shot to the head.
But her clothing is disturbed, isn't it?
It is, but I'm not sure if that's by the water, by the action of the water, or the action of the killer.
Right, well, it's an important point because her jeans are undone, and actually for water to get jeans undone. We don't know if it's a button, we don't know if it's a zipper, but
and
also...
We don't know if it's the offender or if it's David Lee Nobling, right?
Well, it could be
right.
It could be either, but it doesn't sound like it's the water just because her bra is also pushed up around her neck, which for us, these things are actually very important.
We typically see that kind of thing when there's a sexual assault or sexual activity happening.
Mm-hmm.
And no clothes were found in the car.
Some clothes were found in the car, yes. Inside the car, there were two pairs of underwear and shoes. There was a wallet there as well. She actually wasn't reported missing, I believe, because she had run away before as well. And the parents, I think, had gone to social services to report her missing because obviously that, you know, they had a different process and procedure back at this time. But they were trying to report her missing. But yes, that's how she is found, and it does sound like, yes, he had a gunshot to the head and that he was trying to run from the reports that I've read.
Right. Some of the early newspaper reporting has some odd details of the radio in the pickup truck, David's pickup truck being on, window halfway down, windshield wipers on. I'm not sure they're 100% accurate. Sometimes I find that when I'm going back and reading reports that happened pretty closely to when a particular incident took place, sometimes you do pick up interesting things.
So this is where the investigators, you know, they would have all of this information. And sometimes people, you know, things get put in and they're misinformation. Sometimes actually what's reported right at the start is the accurate thing. But of course, those who are investigating this now would know those details. And things like the driver's window, I mean, we talked about it, Bill, being wound down in each of the cases. It depends which reports you read, but
right.
there are some reports that say in all of these cases that was the situation.
Yeah, I don't know that that detail is 100% accurate, but it's definitely part of the mix. And by the way, when we're talking about sequence now, this is the second of the four killings. It's about a year after September 23rd.
September 23rd.
And do you know if there were shell casings found by the car, just that they were shot there, or?
I know they recovered a bullet from David's head. Sorry to be graphic, but
larger than a 22. I've got. There wasn't much blood.
Yeah. By the way, this is the only one of the Colonial Parkway murders where a gun is used.
Well, where a gun is used to kill.
Yes,
right.
And Jim, you've made the point that a gun could be used to control, and I agree completely. In other words, even if that's not ultimately the weapon that's used, certainly if someone produces a gun, you start doing exactly what they tell you to do.
You gain compliance far quicker.
Right.
And, you know, I also believe that David Nobling, he was only wearing his pants. He didn't have anything on his top half. I don't know if that's a detail that you know about, but all these things are really important. The devil is always in the detail for us.
Right.
But I don't know whether you would
I did know that. You know, if they were partially disrobed in the car, maybe fooling around or whatever, and they were interrupted while distracted, that's certainly a possibility. But, yeah, he's found with no shirt on.
Yeah. I mean, those sequence of events, again, you know, you're taking someone by surprise if that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are on the back foot. So just working out sort of the timeline and the sequencing. I mean, it's difficult in a historical case when you haven't got those details in front of you. You haven't got the crime scene photos. You're trying to make sense of things from a distance and reliant upon lots of conflicting reports, actually, which isn't helpful, really.
No, that's true. And unfortunately, when you have a case like this that stretches on, kind of almost urban legends get mixed in.
I was going to say, yeah.
Fiction becomes fact.
I'm wondering when they started being coined as the Colonial Park murders. I mean, when did people, I mean, was it right away when the second couple was killed?
No,
or like when did it start to have that?
You know, I'm not sure. It's funny. One of my things on my to-do list for this week is there are some details that I think I've got wrong. And I know you both said as investigators, going there and walking the sites and putting yourself in the mindset of the victims and then of the killer or killers, I think can be very helpful. I make no pretense to being an investigator. I was there for a purpose, but I thought I've flown all the way across the country. I certainly want to go to these sites, not just where my sister and her girlfriend were found, but all of them. But I learned so much, and some of it was, I'm not sure that this all of these details hang together in the way that
right.
I think they should.
Like what? What details are those?
One of the things that was really interesting was to meet people that were there 30 years ago. And so, for example, two of the photographers I met this week have shot this site as photographers. They said they pointed out some problematic areas where, for instance, there was a failure to control the original crime scene. We're back to October 1986 when Kathy and Becky were found. They said, you know, they didn't tape off the scene. Now, of course, you would secure a crime scene. So they said people were tramping all over the place. So when people tell me, oh, we found no evidence up on the flat area of the pull-off, and then two people that were there that day say, Bill, there were dozens of people walking all over the place. They were driving cars and trucks through there. And these are veteran photographers. They said, we would have never been able to get this close today to a crime scene, let alone an FBI.
So it wasn't cordoned off at all for the sounds of it.
Not at all.
It was pre-OJ.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Another important point, because that revolutionized, it changed everything to do with forensics, both mm-hmm. in the U.S., but also, you know, around the globe. So.
And they were describing first responders, again, well-meaning, getting in and out of the car, you know, over and over again. We've heard the same thing with Keith and Cassandra's Toyota Celica.
But first responders?
Typically National Park Service Rangers, and then it would have been, you know, like emergency personnel that would have been there to...
Yeah, I mean, for emergency personnel, you know, they're not forensically trained, but National Park Service guys should be at least... the investigators there, but
And like we said, when some of them are responding, they're trying to preserve life. They're trying to keep people alive. And that's their immediate response.
Of course. Sure.
That, again, would cause contamination, as we discussed in our first podcast on this.
So on my last day there, I had an opportunity to visit the site where Daniel Lauer, who was 21, and Anna Maria Phelps, who was 18, disappeared. They were on their way to Virginia Beach, and their car was found abandoned at a New Kent County rest stop off this interstate, I-64.
Just to give the context here again and to remind our listeners, so this, she is the fiance to his brother. Is that right there?
He is, although it's much clearer from talking to people that there was some romantic thing going on with the brother as well.
Hmm.
Who knows? Maybe both. They were young.
So, but she, I was led to believe that she was, sorry, the brother, Daniel, was moving in with them as a couple.
Correct. And you know, I learned this week that she may have been more interested in the brother, Daniel, than she was in his brother, Clint, who was allegedly her boyfriend. It was a fluid situation.
Right. Yeah, interesting. And it was like a 2 to 3 hour drive, wasn't it? That
correct.
They were driving to the house and they just didn't appear the other end.
Right. And so my understanding is that now we're back to September 1989 and their bodies were found 6 weeks later. They left in the evening. The family tells me the news was on, so it was probably 11 o'clock. They're heading eastbound.
And this is on the I-64, is it?
Right. And I-64 is a major highway. Two lanes in either direction, 65 mile an hour speed limit, some 70 actually in some spots. So you move along pretty well. There are two rest stops on either side, which are directly opposite one another. If they were heading from Amelia County to Virginia Beach, should have been heading eastbound. However, when the car is found, it's in the westbound, headed back.
So the opposite direction of travel.
Correct.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Only in the first example are bodies found with cars. After that, the cars and the people are separated. And it appears that cars are moved in every example.
And they're barely an hour from the place that the place they started from, right?
Right.
The origin of their journey.
When I was driving back and forth on I-64 that day because
right.
I was trying to get a sense of what would this be like. Now, the rest areas have been improved quite a bit since then. They're still 60 or 70 miles away from Virginia Beach, so they have a ways to go. But ultimately, they go missing. And the
why this is so interesting and helpful to us, that you've driven this and you know
right.
all the
yeah.
detail of it and you can situate us and tell us about it.
And one thing is very clear, though. You could walk. So, for example, to Jim's point, if you were moving cars and you moved it from one side to the other, one person could leave one vehicle on the eastbound side, drive Lauer's car over to the westbound side.
And that would be accomplished. Is there an overpass, or they'd have to go down to the next exit, turn around,
you have two
and
options.
Come back up?
You have two options. You have an overpass that's down less than a mile. I didn't clock it, but it comes up pretty quickly. It's for the New Kent County Courthouse.
Okay.
It's marked as such. And you could cross over and then go back. There's also those turnarounds, you know, in the middle of the median that most of us don't use because those are usually reserved for
state police
and folks like that. I've used them once or twice, but you're always thinking, you know, don't let me get caught doing this. But it would be pretty easy to, without attracting attention, in other words, without using the state police turnarounds, to go down to the next turnoff. And by the way, the next turnoff is where the bodies are found.
That's what I was going to ask you. What purpose would it serve moving them to the westbound side or moving the car to the westbound side?
I'm not sure.
But didn't it delay discovery of the body for 6 weeks, the bodies for 6 weeks?
Yeah.
I mean, if they were right where the car was found, then people would have been searching that area and they probably would have found the bodies earlier and there would have been a lot more forensic evidence and you would have been able to at least tell how Lauer died. I mean, you couldn't tell because the decomposition was so bad.
Right.
Was the car found immediately? Can you remember, recall?
I think the car is found pretty quickly because the car's kind of in a funny spot. It's in the acceleration lane, you know, the place where you're leaving you know, when you're done, it's on the ramp kind of leading back to the highway. So it's not close to the buildings, that, you know, where you go and use the restroom and that kind of thing.
Where there's most activity, right?
Right.
But it's
obvious.
It
would be like what I think of as the quietest corner of the entire layout and far away from all the buildings.
Right. And her purse and clothing is found in the car.
Correct. And so then we drove to the next exit. And now that I've sorted out the directions, which would be, you know, a little bit further east. And, you know, you stop and take a left and you cross over the highway. And then you drive into a kind of a rural area. And again, it's different now than it was 30 years ago. There's a bunch of construction there now, and they're building kind of looks like light industrial. Back then it was, you know, more woods and trees. But a lot of that stuff is still there. But you go about a half a mile in on this state road, and I had a pretty good idea what I was looking for, and I had some photographs to guide us. And there's a turn, and now the road is blocked off with a, you know, a chain and a sign, several signs that say no trespassing. I decided, I felt like trespassing.
So. You were doing an investigation.
Right. I was marching around. I was trying to do something worthwhile. And the signs actually clearly indicate that the area is owned by a hunting club. And I remember that that hunters discovered the body. So they discovered the body 6 weeks later. So the road is a logging road. It's quite wide. It's improved, as they would say. They've actually put some gravel down so that you could drive big logging trucks up in there. And there's actually quite a complex of roads back there. It almost looks like they may plan to build houses or something like that there someday, because you maybe they cut the roads for logging purposes, because you go along and the road could be 20 feet or more wide in spots and very level and smooth. You could totally drive a car in there if it is in the same condition in 2016 that it was back then. But it's not a situation that would require a four-wheel drive or anything like that. You could have driven a Chevy Nova in there without any problem. And as I understand it, these hunters found the two bodies just off the dirt road, covered with a blanket, about 6 weeks after they went missing.
Now, this blanket is from the car. Is that correct?
It's from
Daniel's car.
That's correct.
The blanket's been taken, and they've been intentionally disposed of, but also covered in that
that's
blanket.
Correct.
And that's something different than any of the other cases, by
correct.
The way.
Yeah.
But what isn't different is the fact that Phelps died of a stab wound. So that is a consistent characteristics from the first murders as well.
I think multiple, isn't it? She's got marks on her bones, from what they can tell.
Right. And interestingly, their bodies were sent to the Smithsonian. I think they were actually asking them to do advanced forensics. I think they were looking for more information about cause of death and that kind of thing. I think the results were inconclusive.
Well, this sounds like a good time to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors. And now we're back from the break and back into the case.
One thing I did want to ask you,
is
there a significance that none of these bodies were really buried and tried to be hidden? I mean, it sounds like some attempt was made, but you know what I mean? Like you've talked about before, when somebody buries a body, it's maybe a sign of remorse or connection
No. Yeah, not a sign of remorse.
I mean,
When somebody spends the time to bury a body, it's typically because there is a known connection between that person and the victim. To take the time to be with a body that long, to have dug a hole, to have spent all that time and then burying, covering up, and making it look like they're not there.
Increases
all that stuff.
The risk.
Yeah, it definitely increases the risk to the offender. So
there's got to be a higher payoff to take that risk right. in the first place.
And so, unless the other reason is for to prevent somebody from knowing that something bad happened to that person, and of course, if you do that, you get rid of the car as well. You don't leave the car out in a yeah. place that it makes it look it abandoned and then hope that nobody's going to think something bad happened to the person. So it would be, in this case, if somebody buried these victims, I would think that that's a lot of time. Now, there's one type of burial that is very quick, and that's a water burial. And I think that was attempted in your sister's case, and it may have been successful in the case of Call and Haley, because their bodies were never found. But it was obviously, again, near the water, and it could have been successful. He may have learned the first attempt to try to get rid of the bodies by pushing the car, rolling the car down the hill into the river, didn't work because it got hung up on brambles and sticks and things like that, or trees. So he may have learned from his mistakes in that case.
And we don't know how long, I mean, you know, all this activity would take time. And we don't know whether there was an interruption or, you know, hears mm-hmm. a noise or is startled right. and actually stops the activity.
Right.
And so it's not fully, you know, completed in some senses. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely, if these cases are linked,
right.
and that's a big if, then
right.
there's, of course, a learning process that's going on too. But I still think it's a very big if. Because the devil's always in the detail, and just some of the details we don't quite have.
No. Well, this has been really great discussing this with you, Bill, and I know Laura and I have been fascinated by the details you've been able to provide us in this case, and I'm sure Lisa has been as well.
Yeah, I had never even heard of this case, which I know probably shocks you because you've been living with it for so long, and I'm just so fascinated by it.
And the way that you speak about it, I mean, it's incredible. Just, you know, I said it before, but you're just depth of knowledge. But, you know, in your passion and your commitment and going back there this week, you know, can't have been easy, and going to the crime scenes. I mean, we approach it from we want to hear all of those details. And I know you're very happy to tell us about those things. But, you know, we understand it's not an easy thing. And, you know, we really want to thank you for your time and helping us understand what went on. And we really hope that on the 30th anniversary, you know, new things will come to light. And you spent a lot of time with the media too and people who were there at the time. And I know you found that very helpful.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate all of your interest and your thoughtfulness and your expertise. And it's great to sit in a room with really smart people talking about something that's of great interest to me.
Well, we certainly appreciate you being here and sharing this with us. And we hope to continue to talk to you about this as time goes on and around the 30th anniversary and beyond, if necessary.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.